This afternoon, I'd like to explore some about bringing our mindfulness practice, our spiritual practice, into the fullness of our lives beyond retreat practice. And I'll do this by exploring a teaching from the Buddhist texts called Clear Comprehension. The Pali term for this is sampajanya, which is translated in various ways, either as clear comprehension or as full awareness or full alertness. One of the main places this term is used is in the Buddha's instructions for mindfulness, his main teaching on how to do mindfulness practice, the four foundations of mindfulness. And it's found quite a bit in the foundation of body. There's a section. I'll read a section of this to you that uses this term quite a bit. And here, this is Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, and he translates it as full awareness. A practitioner is one who acts in full awareness when going forward and returning, who acts in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away, who acts in full awareness when flexing and extending one's limbs, who acts in full awareness when wearing, this is talking to a monk here, when wearing robes, so when wearing our clothes, who acts in full awareness when wearing our clothes and in carrying our dishes, who acts in full awareness when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting, who acts in full awareness when defecating and urinating, who acts in full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping silent. So this really, right here in the Buddha's teaching, he's looking at how do we bring our mindfulness right into everything that we do. Nothing left out. Nothing left out. Any activity that you engage in falls into one of these categories. The simplicity of extending and bending the limbs, that happens all the time. You know, pretty much any activity we're doing this extending and bending of limbs. Or if we're in stillness, we're sitting, standing, walking. Or we're talking or remaining silent. Perhaps we're urinating or defecating. I'm impressed that he put that in there. You know, it's like what you might think the most, you know, profane thing included in this spiritual text. And so he really is encouraging us to be aware, be fully aware in all activities. So this, to me, this conveys quite a bit of the sense of mindfulness in our life, mindfulness in everything. A real emphasis on continuity of mindfulness, the no gaps that Kamala's been talking about. So this continuity of attention is so helpful for our practice on retreat, and so we've been encouraging it on retreat. And, you know, the practice of continuity of mindfulness while eating, while making your bed, while carrying your dishes, all of that brings the practice closer to what happens in our daily lives. So on retreat, we have that possibility of practicing with continuity. And those ways of engaging in our practice here, those are closer to things that we do at home. You know, when we go home, we may spend an hour or maybe two or maybe more if we have time a day in sitting meditation. But the vast majority of our day will be spent in acting. And so this encouragement to open to be present for everything that happens. As we've talked about, this continuity of mindfulness begins to open us to a real understanding. We start to see causes and conditions. We start to understand how our minds respond to things, how we get impatient or confused or frustrated. We start to understand how our minds react. And that very understanding begins to free us, as we've been saying all this week. Also, I think in this exploration of how we're engaging in the world and seeing essentially the consequences of how we're engaging in the world, our minds begin to get an education. We see, for instance, an activity, a reaction, and watch consequences unfolding and begin to understand what activities and purposes and motivations serve us to be happy, serve us to move towards well-being. And so the Buddha encourages us to have this continuity of mindfulness in all activities. In fact, in the Satipatthana Sutta, one commentator pointed out that there's a lot of exercises in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. I can't remember quite how many, 16 or maybe more practices that are explored, mindfulness practices in the Satipatthana Sutta. And only one of those practices does the Buddha explicitly say, sit down cross-legged and close your eyes to engage. And that one is for mindfulness of breathing. All the rest of them, my understanding is all the rest of them we can engage with in our activities of whatever we're doing. Mindfulness of feeling tone, whether things are pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Mindfulness of our state of our mind can be engaged with. Mindfulness of posture, standing, walking, sitting, lying down. All of these things can be engaged with right through our lives. Another place this word, actually, if you listen to this, what I described here, it's describing acting in full awareness when engaging in activities. But it doesn't actually tell us what full awareness is here. It just gives us the idea that we should be acting in full awareness while doing all of these things. And elsewhere in this sutta, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, at the beginning, actually, this quality of full awareness or clear comprehension is used as when the Buddha says, well, what is mindfulness? What is right mindfulness? He uses full awareness, this term sampajanya, as one of the qualities that defines right mindfulness. Some others are alertness. The phrase is, one abides contemplating ardent, fully aware, and mindful. That's his definition for what right mindfulness is. So we bring to mind, we abide contemplating our body, we abide contemplating feelings, bringing those to mind with alertness, with this quality of full awareness, and with sati, or with mindfulness, which one of the definitions of that, the term sati, is actually connected to the word memory. So essentially remembering the present moment, we could say. So this term full awareness is defined elsewhere in the texts. And the actual definition that I found, the Buddha actually describes, how does somebody practice clear comprehension? How does somebody practice full awareness? And he says, to practice full awareness, one is aware of feelings, this pleasant, unpleasant, neutral experience. One's aware of feelings as they arise, as they persist, as they pass away. One's aware of thoughts as they arise, as they persist, as they pass away. One's aware of perceptions as they arise, as they persist, as they pass away. And so this is bringing a kind of a fairly clear mind to whatever is happening. It's not just about knowing that you're walking while you're walking, although that's certainly supportive in our practice, but this understanding, going beyond simply body awareness, actually understanding what's happening in our minds. So full awareness includes looking at mental activity as well. One of the ways I understand this definition is that clear awareness, first of all, there's the piece of clearly knowing how our minds are in relationship to whatever's going on. So how are we feeling? What are the feelings that are coming up with? How are we relating to it in terms of concepts, and what thoughts come up around it, so that we're clearly aware of how we're relating to experience, and knowing that mental activity. And because he says this, is aware of when things arise, persist, and pass away, it's pointing to the impermanent nature of this flow of mental activity. So this, in the commentary about the section of the sutta that I read, Bhikkhu Bodhi says, this is actually a fairly, it's pointing to a fairly intimate connection with our activities. So an intimacy with knowing what's happening moment to moment, not just in the body, but in the mind. Actually knowing what's happening in the mind, and we've been talking about this a lot on this retreat. That's really where it's at in terms of understanding suffering. Because it's our mind's engagement, it's our relationship with activity, with thoughts, with emotions, it's our relationship to everything that happens in the world, where our suffering comes. And so this clear comprehension includes understanding how we're relating to activity. And the commentaries actually bring in and say, this teaching around clear comprehension is, there's a lot of emphasis on looking at our purpose, looking at the aim and purpose of our activities. Not that we just simply know that we're walking while we're walking, but that we understand why we're walking. We understand that this activity is supportive of the Dharma. So the commentaries actually explore this term in quite a bit of depth, and this is really where I'd like to talk about this full awareness from this perspective of how do our activities support us in terms of waking up. And the commentaries say that this aspect really brings wisdom to bear on our mindfulness. One of my teachers, Sayadaw Utejaniya, often says, you know, awareness is not enough. Simple awareness, just knowing, yep, this is happening, yep, this is happening, yep, this is happening, isn't really enough. That there needs to be a perspective of wisdom, of understanding what we're aware of, and the aim of that awareness, not just simply being to be aware, but to understand what leads us to suffering and what takes us away from suffering. So the Sayadaw Utejaniya says, it's really about awareness wisdom together. And really it's my understanding that this aspect of right mindfulness, the definition of right mindfulness, including this piece, clear comprehension, this is where the wisdom comes in. It's like the mindfulness instructions that the Buddha offers are embedded with wisdom. And this is one of the explorations. So the commentaries say that this exploration of full awareness, of clear comprehension, begin to help us to understand how our activities, whatever we're doing, can support our understanding of the Dharma, turning our exploration of whatever we're doing to see, can it come into alignment with the Dharma? Can we turn our everyday activities, urinating and defecating, eating, talking, towards deepening understanding? So how can our, whatever we do, be something that actually supports our waking up? Maybe this sounds like restrictive, or, you know, like, does everything have to be completely purposeful, you know? But consider how when we are engaging with something that is meaningful to us, with something that feels like it points us in a direction of where our aspirations lie, how much more joy there is in our lives than when we're just kind of wandering around doing this and that. When our activities are kind of in line with our heart's wish. There's more meaning, more joy, I think, in our lives. So the commentaries have this, like, broken down, this exploration of clear comprehension broken down from several different perspectives. And I'm going to talk about some of these perspectives. I don't know if I'll get to all of them. I'd like to primarily talk about two of them. It's said that the commentaries say that there's clear comprehension of purpose and clear comprehension of suitability, and these two are very related to each other. I think I understand these as being related to the content of our lives, the aim of our activity. Primarily in terms of our actions, our body and our speech and our bodily actions. And the commentaries say that this aspect of clear comprehension connects us to what we're doing and why we're doing it, and begins to join us to the aspiration of the Dharma within whatever we're doing. So how can the practical purposes of ordinary life be connected with our highest aspirations, with our heart's wish? So this is the exploration, this is one of the explorations around clear comprehension. I think one of the first things that we can do here is to reflect on, first of all, what our priorities are. What is it that we really want to do in our lives? What are our deepest aspirations? Taking some time to actually reflect on that. And this reflection can be refined. I mean, we might initially, you know, just if we start by reflecting on what is my deepest aspiration? It might be we think about, something we'd like to do. But I think that this, you know, we might think, gosh, I'd really like to accomplish this or that in my life. But this reflection on aspiration, I think, asks us to come back more to the motivation. Why do we want to do things? What is the underlying purpose, the underlying motivation, why we'd want to do something? So in this reflection, you know, taking some time to reflect on what are your priorities and what is your deepest aspiration, and are these connected? Are your priorities in life connected with your deepest aspiration? So this reflection, and not to rush it, not to think you have to find the answer. I remember the first time my teacher asked me to, you know, what is your deepest aspiration? I was like, well, I have no idea. I want to be liked, you know. I don't know. And I sat with the question. So let yourself sit with the question. And then at some point, my heart responded with, you know, this wish for peace, basically. A wish for peace, for freedom. So this, you know, the aspiration, our deepest aspirations are probably going to be connected with beautiful qualities of mind, such as the wish to be kind, the wish to be compassionate. It will often, I think, be something that's connected to a deep kind of meaning in our lives. The Dalai Lama said, my religion is kindness. You know, so that to me speaks to his deep intention towards kindness. And in fact, it said, I think he said, he's the one that said, whenever possible, be kind. And it's always possible to be kind. So orienting, you know, when we come or touch in with what our deepest aspiration is, we can begin to look, are our activities connected to that? So you know, how might a simple activity, like, you know, we have to engage with the world, right? You know, we We have things to take care of in our lives. We have to go to the grocery store. We have to, you know, earn a livelihood or take care of our kids or whatever we have to do in our daily lives. And the pointing here, the pointing here is not that somehow we have to not do the things of our daily life in order to fulfill our deepest aspiration, but find a way to weave that thread of our deepest aspiration through what we do. Now, going to the grocery store, a simple activity, the obvious intention to buy our food, to sustain our bodies. Just that, buying food to sustain our bodies, you know, that activity, we can reflect on how that is a reflection of kindness to ourselves and to our families. If we just go to the store and buy the food and, you know, don't reflect on how it's connected with our purpose, we lose an opportunity to deepen our both deepen our intention towards that purpose and to have the joy that this everyday activity is supporting our purpose. You know, how many times have I gone to the grocery store and just tried to get it over with? Or it's like, I've got better things to do. Well, do I really have better things to do than buy my food to feed myself? You know, it's like, this is an important activity. Can I engage with it? Can I recall the connection it has with my Dharma purpose? We also might explore, in a simple activity like that, orienting to other intentions that we might connect with. Kindness and friendliness, for example. Gil, at one point, said that this really stuck with me. He said, one of my practices right now, it's an intention practice. It's my calendar practice. I look at my calendar every morning, and I look at all the things I need to do this day. Okay, I need to go grocery shopping. I have a meeting with this person. I have to pick up my kid at school, whatever, you know, just all of the various activities of his day. And he spent some time reflecting in advance, what's the intention I want to bring to that activity? Not the simple, you know, just simply, oh yeah, I've got to do that to pick up my kid at school, or I've got to do that to buy the food, but what's the intention I want to bring to that activity? We could bring the intention of kindness in going to the grocery store, having, you know, reflecting on it in advance, thinking, okay, bringing that intentionality. We might remember when we're at the cashier, you know, checking out, to, you know, be friendly to the cashier instead of being self-absorbed or, you know, and I'm not talking about like a deep, soulful gaze into their eyes. You know, I'm just like talking about a smile and a, hi, how are you today, you know? Just bringing that intention of friendliness, of kindness. You know, there's a period of time where I used the Safeway as my metta monastery. Every time I went into the Safeway, I started practicing metta to everyone that I saw. Boy, did it transform my relationship to the Safeway. And it just transformed my relationship to all the people. There was a guy behind the sandwich counter. I worked right near a Safeway, and I went in and I got sandwiches at lunch. And he was not very quick at preparing the sandwiches. And the line kind of sometimes grew. And I just watched. I was watching, and I was like, you know, wishing him well, and you know, and I just really got this sense that he was really engaged with making these sandwiches. You know, he poured his heart into making these sandwiches, And somebody was standing next to me one day and said, "Oh, things are a little slow here." And I said, "Oh, but they're made with love." I don't know if it transformed her relationship, but I was just like, just kind of just enjoying watching how carefully he made the sandwiches, you know. So it just really transformed my relationship to so much. So what is our intention as we engage in our activities? You know, you're in the grocery store, you might as well practice metta. Or, you know, whatever works for you. You know, it may not be the formal metta practice, but just the practice of smiling. That was another practice I played with for a while, that I was on my walk around the neighborhood, and I just began, you know, if people looked at me, you know, I wasn't like trying to make them look at me, because sometimes people don't want to look at you when they're walking around, but if somebody caught my eye, I would just smile. And wow, is it rewarding when somebody smiles back? You know, that intention to connect with kindness like rippled back many times over. I actually timed it at one point. It's like the joy I felt while having somebody smile at me. It lasted about 40 seconds. And then it began, you know, softening. And but 40 seconds of happiness for a smile, I mean, that's pretty inexpensive happiness. So this, you know, then there can be also looking at larger intentions. You know, so bringing our intentions of kindness, of to whatever we do, but also, for instance, in the grocery store, looking at the impact of our choices. What kind of products are we buying, and what kind of impact does that have on our environment? So, you know, this also, you know, can be part of our exploration. How do we live in the world? As we do this exploration of our intention, and can we act from our intention in this way, bring our intention to our activities, we're likely to find some rub. We're likely to find some places or ways that we're not acting in line with our aspirations. Or sometimes when, you know, with this mindfulness, we may start to see that there's part of us that is kind of trying to convince us that we're acting skillfully or acting in line with our best interests, but our idea of what our best interest can be sometimes can be diluted. You know, how many things in this world have happened in the name of good intention? And so to really be honest with ourselves about that. So, you know, wishing for happiness is a wholesome aspiration, and looking at, is there so many unwholesome things are done in the name of wanting to be happy. And the Buddhist teaching on non-harming is really helpful here in this exploration, and as a kind of form of honesty for ourselves when we are acting in the world, even if we're thinking we're acting from skillful intention, thinking we're acting from kindness or friendliness. Oh, I just want to help this person. Looking at what happens as we engage, the Buddha suggested to his own son, a teaching he gave to his own son when his son was 7 years old. He said, Look at your intentions before you act. Look at your actions and reflect. Is this going to cause suffering to either yourself or another person? And If you don't see that it's going to cause harm, go ahead and do it. While you're doing it, look at, is it causing harm? And if you see that it is, stop. If you see that it's not, you can continue. And after an action has been finished, see, is it causing harm? Has it caused harm to yourself or another? And if it has, learn from it, basically. Learn from it. Not beat yourself up about it. But he says, undertake restraint in the future. But I really think that the call here is to reflect on what did I not understand? What did I not understand in this situation? You know, this is a great practice, this exploration around when we act, does it cause suffering or harm for ourselves or others? A great way to help us uncover the deluded ways that our mind, you know, thinks, oh yes, this is a good thing to do. The reality of whether suffering comes helps us to understand some of those delusions. Now, I'm not saying there's no way actually to act in the world without other people reacting. You're not going to find the perfect, you know, set of actions in the world. We all have to work from our best intention and then learn from that if we see there is harm. So an example of this, I've used this a lot, many of you have probably heard me tell this story, but it demonstrates what I'm meaning here. So I want to give an example to help convey this. There's a story of a young boy who was a kind of a budding naturalist, and he actually grew up to be a kind of a famous naturalist. And when he was young, 11 years old, he had a collection of chrysalids, the cocoons that turn into butterflies. And he was anxiously watching and waiting for the butterflies to come out, and he saw them start to crack open. He saw one of them one day start to crack open, and he watched as this butterfly emerged from the cocoon and saw how the butterfly, you know, the wings like pried open the crack, and how the abdomen distended and this fluid pumped out, and just so much struggle to crack open that chrysalis. And finally the butterfly emerged and flew off. And then as the other chrysalid started to crack open, the young naturalist thought he would spare them the suffering of emerging from the cocoon and pried open the cocoons for them. And what happened was the butterflies slid out, walked around on the ground for a little while, and dropped dead. So the intention in his heart as an 11-year-old was, oh, that's suffering. I don't want them to suffer. What he didn't understand was that that suffering was necessary for their life. That fluid had to, the exertion of opening the crack was necessary to have the fluid pump out over their wings, which enabled them to fly. So he says years later, you know, that that intentions, you know, looking at intentions that way had been a huge lesson for him, understanding that what seems to be kind may be the reverse of kind. So the exploration is, if there is suffering that results from your activity, you know, in this case there was suffering that resulted in both sides, right? He saw the suffering of the butterfly emerging from his perceived suffering of the butterfly as it emerged, and then he saw the suffering of the butterflies dying because they couldn't fly. And so The question I think he must have asked himself is, what did I not understand? So this is the question we can ask ourselves when we see that actions lead to suffering. Is there something that I didn't understand? And sometimes, no matter how skillful our intentions are, there will always be people that, there will always be situations where people have different perspectives. Always be different perspectives on a situation. And there may not be a right answer. And suffering may be found on either side. That there's not necessarily always a way to engage without suffering resulting. And yet our practice is to understand it as best we can, to keep trying to understand. So this uncovering of delusion, we can beat ourselves up sometimes, that example, I could envision the little boy like going to bed in tears at night, for having killed the butterflies. And so as we see our mistakes, as we see our confusion with mindfulness, to have compassion for that. Nyanaponika Thera, who explored this teaching on clear comprehension quite extensively, he said, he has a lovely phrase, "We aim for a peaceful penetration of the irrational regions of our mind." So, not a harsh beating ourselves up when we see this. I've been exploring, looking at our purpose, looking at our, what is our aspiration? What is our purpose? So this is a clear comprehension of purpose, my understanding, the clear comprehension of purpose. A second aspect of clear comprehension is clear comprehension of suitability. The word suitability. What practices and activities are suitable for us? So this is also related to purpose, related to our aspiration, our motivation. It's also related to the realities of our lives. Kind of one way to frame this exploration of suitability is, what activities are skillful given the context of our lives and our practice? So a simple example that came up just the other day, the different practices may be suitable for us at different times. Just, what's suitable at one time may not be suitable at another time. And so this takes discernment. I talked about how sometimes when anger arose for me, I could observe it and be with it. And sometimes I had to bow to it and say, not now. My mindfulness isn't strong enough right now. So the discernment of knowing what is suitable for us. Sometimes a metta practice might be suitable. Sometimes investigation might be suitable. Sometimes skillful ignoring might be suitable. So understanding the context of our lives, if you are in a business meeting, noting every instance of your experience is not going to be very helpful in your engagement with that meeting. Thinking, planning, pulsing. You're not going to be able to connect with the context of the activity. So that practice in that situation is not suitable. Nyanaponikatera has another phrase here. He says that this teaching on clear comprehension of suitability points us to learn the art of the practicable. You know, it's not always possible to choose for us. It's not always possible to choose an activity that's going to be the most like connected with our aim and purpose. So reflecting on the activities that you do engage in, again, this is very similar to what I talked about before, but reflecting on the activities that you engage in and seeing, you know, many of them may not be terribly connected to your highest aspirations. Some of them, perhaps, we can honestly evaluate and look at and say, you know, maybe that one's not so helpful in my life. So looking honestly at your activities, and are there activities, one activity I see that does not serve me is when my mind gets caught by Google. I can find myself sitting in front of the search engine trying to find something to thinking about, what do I want to know? What do I want to know? And I can get caught by that. And, you know, that activity I really see, you know, that is not helpful. It does not connect with my higher purpose. And I still see myself getting caught with it. When I see I'm caught with it, okay, find a way to let go of that. So there are some activities that we engage in that we have to be honest with ourselves and say, you know, that one's not helpful. How can I? And I do find myself, it's really great when I'm on retreat because it's so clear. I mean, that activity is just, it takes me right away from the retreat. And I just find myself, I love that that recognition. It happens really fast when I'm on retreat. Oh, there I am wanting to find something. It's like, I just close the computer. It's like, poof, just shut it off. Then there are all the activities that we absolutely need to engage in, and yet we may think they don't connect to our purpose. You know, for a long time, I was in contention with my livelihood before I switched to being a full-time Dharma teacher. I was a technical writer, and I resented that time taken by going into, I worked at Sony and wrote manuals on 3D graphics interfaces. And, you know, it's kind of like, how does this connect to my deepest aspiration? Well, yes, I can be mindful while I'm doing this. I can bring mindfulness to what I'm doing. And I did. I cultivated the mindfulness in that way. But still, it felt like there were better ways I could use my time. Until at some point I realized, you know, this is actually my livelihood. It is not an unwholesome livelihood. It is not wrong livelihood. And this activity is supporting me to be able to go on retreat. It's supporting me to be able to practice the Dharma. And when I had that kind of switch of context around the work, this isn't in the way of practice. This is what's enabling me to practice. That completely shifted my relationship to work, that reframing of the activity. So I understood it now as suitable. I understood that activity as suitable for my life. So this clear comprehension of suitability doesn't mean that sometimes we think we have agendas about what suitability and purpose means, right? You know, things need to be completely aligned with our highest aspiration. That means I need to be doing something actively every single moment of the day, engaged to that purpose. Actually, sometimes something that's completely connected with our aspiration is to sit quietly with a cup of tea and look out a window. To let go of the busyness of our lives. You know, have a nice dinner with friends. To foster connection with Sangha. You know, things that, so check in and see if you've got some idea about what it means to be engaging in a purposeful and suitable way. Skillful means will probably include times of rest and ease. And we need to look at the motivation, the underlying intention behind what we're doing. That's where it's connected to purpose, in that underlying intention. Are we sitting and having a cup of tea because we are avoiding something? Or are we sitting and having a cup of tea as a way to allow the mind to nourish itself with some rest and relaxation? Now, mixed motivations will exist. I think until we're enlightened, we'll see that both that cup of tea being, you know, the intention to nourish ourselves with some place of space, and I can't deal with that right now. You know, it's like it's got both motivations going. And so looking at this, it's like pretty much most of our activities are going to have mixed motivations. I'd say probably until we're fully enlightened, there'll be mixed motivations. And so, you know, being friendly with yourself about that, and being honest with yourself too about those mixed motivations. Not letting your, oh, I'm just being compassionate with myself right now, obscure the fact that, yeah, I actually don't want to look at that right now. Let yourself be honest. Yeah, right now, that wanting to push away is happening. That aversion to that thing is happening. Clearly acknowledging that. You don't have to then say, you know, oh, I better look at that right now. Skillful means maybe, not now, but clearly acknowledging that's what we've been talking about, looking at our attitude, you know, looking at our relationship to experience. When we can clearly acknowledge our unskillful motivations like that, they have much less of an opportunity of making our choices for us. And that's a lot what happens in our lives when we're not cognizant of our unskillful motivations. Those motivations have us deciding and choosing and doing all kinds of things. So without awareness, our unskillful motivations kind of run the show. When we can be honest with ourselves about them, there's the possibility of kind of what I say sometimes is we can land in the wholesome motivation a little more fully, acknowledge the unwholesome motivation, see if we cannot act out of the unwholesome motivation. You know, when we take an action, for instance, we may see that part of the action is coming out of anger and part of it's coming out of compassion. Can we begin to tease those apart and see if we can, in taking the action, connect a little more fully with the the heart of compassion than the heart of closing down and aversion. So the other point or aspect of clear comprehension, I think, is what I pointed to a few minutes ago around engaging with mindfulness in the midst of our activities, engaging with basically how can everything in our lives be our practice. We are stepping into tomorrow the advanced practice. The conditions here are ideal for the cultivation of mindfulness. We will lose many of these supports as we walk out into the world. And so it becomes an ongoing exploration for us. How do we engage mindfully with all of our activity? This connects to one of the third aspect of clear comprehension, called clear comprehension of domain. And Nyanaponika says this is, you know, not abandoning our mindfulness no matter what activities. His question is, and this is a great question for us, how can the practice of mindfulness be performed under these very circumstances? If you can hold that question in mind in your daily life, you may not know the answer, but holding the question will begin to help that infusion of mindfulness through our daily lives. This is a huge topic. You know, I really can't say a lot right now about this. I teach non-residential retreats on this topic and talk all week about this topic. But I can say that it really can happen. It takes intention. I think that's probably the key. The intention. Anytime we recognize we've forgotten about mindfulness, in that moment when we realize we've forgotten, that moment right there is like waking up on the cushion, having remembered, oh, my mind's been wandering. Be aware. That moment when you realize after a long day, as you're getting into bed, oh my gosh, I haven't been mindful for hours, maybe even at all today. That moment is not a moment to beat yourself up for the hours of non-mindfulness. It's the moment to say, ah, awareness is back. Yay, there's a moment of it in my daily life. What's happening? And in that moment, what I have seen to be the key there, you know, when I first met the teachings of mindfulness, when I had that moment of, oh, I haven't been mindful all day. Actually, I was reading a book on mindfulness. And it was by the side of my bed, and each night I'd pick it up and it'd be like, oh, right, mindfulness. I forgot all day long, and I'd put it down, and the next time I'd remember when I picked up the book the next night, oh, I forgot. And my response at that point, this was when I was in my 20s, my response at that point was like, well, I guess I don't know how to do this. And I tossed the book. Well, I didn't. I put it on my bookshelf. I actually still have the book, but I didn't toss the book. But, you know, I just like, obviously I can't do this. That was my relationship at that point. The second time I encountered mindfulness, I had a more motivation. And any time I noticed, gosh, I've forgotten all this time, the thing that came into my mind was, I'm just going to keep trying. I'm just going to keep trying. That intention ended up being incredibly powerful. You know, when I look back at it, that was what got my practice going, was that intention. When I realized I'd forgotten, I'm just going to keep trying. I'm just going to keep trying. And I discovered, you know, over the course of days of this, I got more of those moments. I'm just going to keep trying. You know, maybe I got three or four of them in a day instead of just one. And it began to role. So that moment when you realize, gosh, I haven't been mindful. Ha, it's here. Notice it. Notice what you have woken up into, and then recommit. I'm just going to keep trying. The practice will unfold from there. The fourth kind of clear comprehension is basically clear comprehension of non-delusion, insight. It's seeing things as they are. And all of this practice, especially the intention, is what allows that to unfold. We don't get to that recognition of how our minds are deluded and confused without all of the work. And it's a result. It's not something we do. It's a result of our practice. And this infusion into our daily lives, you'll start to notice the benefit really quickly if you have that intention. You know, you'll start to notice the benefit. The Buddha said, the Dharma is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. Even the beginning stages, we start to see things in a different way. And our heart knows this is the direction. Our heart knows this is the path. So let's sit for a moment.